You do. Good
All
morning.
right, so let me mute Pal Talk. So what I do is I mute Pal Talk, so I don't get that echo. But
Good
good
idea.
morning. I actually see your shiny face
How
looking
are
at the
you?
computer. I'm good. I'm really good. It's good to see
I
you.
guess I should probably mute the camera too to keep the bandwidth good, huh?
Yeah, that helps a lot. I think that bandwidth thing is
Yeah.
tends to be a kind of a drag on the whole system. So,
Too much information. Tiny mad idea, huh?
yeah, exactly. Way too much. So I see that you have proposed a topic. And somehow or the other, I'm not seeing it now because I've got the Skype open. Let's go
Oh,
here. Let me see.
yeah. I was just thinking. I was contemplating actually. One of my friends made a new Facebook group, and I was thinking about it as it relates to special love, and of course, which is the shadow side, even though we don't think of it as that, as of special hate, which both of which are unreal, and both of which are masks for the perfect oneness, which is the perfect love that we all are and have. And anyway, just it, particularly in the context of all the things that we do in the holidays, and or typically anyway, and there's nothing wrong with any of that, of course, but just to look at the contents of our minds and see how insane the ego is and how silly it is, and ultimately how it's nothing. And anyway, and another thing that I was doing yesterday that might tie into it is listening to one of Ken Wapnick's wonderful audios, and he's mentioned it several times on several audios, I believe, is the and how in the middle of workbook lesson 95, the Jesus of the Course, the author of the course, A Course in Miracles, pauses briefly to interject a reminder or an aside, which is really, in a sense, it's more than an aside. It's really an inside in the commentary that suggests that the whole purpose of doing the workbook lessons, and therefore our mindfulness practice in the greater context, is to not try to be perfect in the world, but in using this workbook lessons as an example, but to do the workbook lessons imperfectly, which is to say, to extrapolate by extrapolation, to do everything in our lives imperfectly, and because there's no way we could, based on the ego standards, do anything perfect, which is why it always comes up
Exactly.
short.
Even though we
But
think we could, and so it's an
yeah.
affront to the ego to say that you can't, but it's the truth.
Right.
And no, and
Right.
it's no wonder that, we're always so confused. So lesson 95, you're saying is,
Yeah, in the middle of it. Let me look it up too. And
I am
you
one self united with my creator, which right then and there, if you said you did these workbook lessons and you don't know this, then then I think you have something else to look at in the lesson personally.
Yeah. So let's see if I can find which. Let's see. I think it starts in about the seventh or eighth paragraph here. Let's see. I've got the Holy Spirit is not delayed in his teaching by your mistakes. Oh, actually, let's go back a paragraph. And then here it's talking about the specific exercise of that lesson. He says, "We will therefore keep to the 5 minutes an hour practice periods for a while and urge you to omit as few as possible." Which is basically, to generalize that specific, it's saying, try to be as mindful as you can, but he's not, again, like Ken Wapnick says, this course isn't addressing the individual specific self that we think we are. It's always talking to the mind, and specifically, even though it's not specific, because in truth there are no specifics, which is the metaphysics of the course, right? That he's addressing the decision-making faculty of the mind as we think of it, which is that pivot on the fulcrum that chooses between this vast illusion of the ego's thought system, which manifests out as a world of space-time and galaxies and atoms and everything in between, including the physical self we are and the persona that we think we are, and that persona is just the tip of the iceberg of the insane thought system that we identify with, that says that separation could be possible. And that's, you know, those are the masks. Those are the facades that we hide behind keep us mindless by intention. That's the purpose of nature of the ego, to keep us forever, you know, hiding and fighting behind these shields of oblivion, as it's talked about toward the last paragraph of, I believe, of one of the last paragraphs in lesson 136, I think it is. But those shields of oblivion are the whole universe that we made up of specialness and special things, and we're on a special planet and a special solar system and a special galaxy, right? and certainly in a special body, in a special house, in a special neighborhood, and especially we go on and on, and then all of our family, of course, is special, but all the things that we do, and I think this is a particularly helpful time of year to look at that, when we think of all the the holiday things that people do, and how oftentimes that leads to seasonal depression and discouragement and frenetic activity and trying to somehow compensate for all the things that didn't happen for us during the year, and just yada yada yada, right?
Oh yeah.
But looking at all the the craziness that the ego foists, that which is again a metaphor for our decision maker choosing an insane thought system and trying to finish out the run. Yesterday, my mother just finished a course of antibiotics. And we think we have to do the same thing with ego. I think we have to, I better finish all the different permutations that ego suggests me to try. I better try every place to live, a vacation spot. I gotta check all these things off my bucket list, right? Or I have to go ahead.
Yeah. And here's, I guess, the most difficult thing for me, and the thing that trips me up the very most, and people will say, well, that's a good thing, but what what really trips me up the most is empathy. And what I see is that whenever I perceive a situation where I believe that somebody else is lacking in something, I immediately go to thought of fear and grief, sadness.
Sure.
I go into this whole spiral of this really, someone told me one day, which I didn't even realize this, when I was talking about how bad I was feeling about everything in the world. And they said, well, Lynn, of course you're going to feel that way. You are an empath. And I was thinking, I don't think I am an empath. I don't think I want to be an empath. I think because that is not.
Where's the resignation papers? Huh?
That's a very painful thing to be. Be completely grief stricken every time somebody gets bombed or somebody's baby gets killed. I just go into this extreme spiral of grief and sorrow, and that is not, honestly, I think that's the thing that holds me up more than anything in my desire to know the truth about myself and the truth about God, because I'm so confounded by these emotions
I think we all are. We're honest with ourselves, aren't we? I mean,
And so empathy is not a good thing the way that the ego uses it. It is not a helpful thing at all. And so, for me, that's the empathy is why, Uncle Sam has had a really difficult time this year. And so, why don't we, invite him over for Christmas because his wife passed, or,
I thought you were talking about the government.
Yeah, really. I know, when I said Uncle Sam, I thought that's not
double,
a forget uncle.
Double entendre there.
It is a double entendre, because I feel that same way about the country. I feel that same way about the world. I feel that same way about, children in Syria and, people who were, just seem to be suffering all around me. That's what brings me to deep grief and suffering. And sure. Of course, all of that is only possible because I believe very firmly in our individual self, our own individual special persons, and that there are individual special persons who can suffer. So that suffering is a big thing for me. And I've really just been asking Holy Spirit, because, you know, I'm not asking to become less kind. I'm not asking to be less loving. I'm asking to see the truth and to go into, you know, what Jesus, you know, calls true empathy, in order to be able to express and experience things in a way that is true to the holy self that I am and the holy self that you are, which is, you know, I don't feel bad for anything that happens to you, not because I don't love you, but because it's not the truth.
Right, and that's not what we are.
It's not what we are.
That's who we are. But right. The who we are is incredibly convincing, dramatic roles that you know, beyond Academy Award winning performances with full of special effects, pun intended, in galactic, you know, pan-galactic proportions, that are so well rehearsed and so, you know, attest to the incredible power of our minds to make up stuff, that we actually believe that we pulled off this whole hoax called space, time, and individuality, and it's just a facade. It's a Truman Show. You know, it's an elaborate game that has no consequence in truth. But like you say, it's so easy to get caught up in that. The other day, when I heard about the shootings in Southern California, my sister lives nearby, and she was just here visiting. In fact, did I mention that last week? I can't remember. I spent the day a week ago yesterday on the beach with my sister and her family, and just had a wonderful time. And in order to avoid the traffic getting back to Southern California where they live, they stopped by here for a day and had a nice short but nice visit with my mother here, where I'm doing a little bit of help while she's recovering from some medical issues here in Northern California. So anyway, my sister had just been here a couple days prior, and she texted me and when we talked, that because she lives in Redlands, and the place where the shooting happened in San Bernardino County was within a mile of where she worked. In fact, she saw the helicopters flying over that afternoon a few days ago, and so you know, it was very close to home for her. And so you know how easy it is for us to get wrapped up in the events of the world, and it would be silly to not be kind and compassionate and to extend whatever support we can and however it seems appropriate, you know, without again, being sensitive to caring for our peace of mind as it relates to everyone else's peace of mind, and seeing them not separate, and doing everything we can, as a seemingly separate self, to extend that kindness and care and support to every other seeming separate self, right? I mean, what would we not want to do in that regard? And yet, like you say, there's that awareness that says, oh, what I am and what the people in every aspect of that drama in Southern California or in the Middle East, or you know, pick in Syria, pick your favorite, you know, hotspot or newsworthy item, as we consider things newsworthy, you know, in this insane world. And why wouldn't we feel the utmost compassion and positive regard for all involved, seemingly the victims and victimizers, equally, by recognizing that that's not what we really are, that we've, you know, taken on this masquerade in with such finesse and such brilliant acting, and we've identified with the roles so fully that why wouldn't we get caught up in it? And yet, that's our way out. of recognizing that we don't have to change our behavior. We don't have to you know, stop doing the expressions of kindness and the hugs and the you know, financial support for people, you know, victims of tragedies, if we're in a position to do that, or you know, whatever, you know, tragedies as the world thinks of them, and you know, to do the things we can to support a kinder, more egalitarian planet. But at the same time, if we kind of watch the contents of our minds and say, well, what drew me to this study? That is, it's really the awareness that there is a loving presence within all of us, however deeply masked or covered over, that is our reality. And that could not possibly be put out, whether by bullets or, you know, megaton bombs or viruses or tidal waves or what, you know, pick, you know, any seeming mechanism by which the things that come and go, you know, arise and seem to arise and seem to depart. And but what a convincing thing, huh? And
it is,
and,
yeah. So your topic that you were asking about, perfect oneness contrasted with special love, and you mentioned hate, but all, I mean, special love is everything that is saying that you and I are different.
Right.
And
right.
So it doesn't matter whether I love you, whether I hate you, whether I grieve and mourn over what happened to you, whether I rejoice when I see bad things going on, which Donald Trump said that thousands of people were cheering at 9/11. You know, it's just all of that is complete and total BS. And so perfect oneness contrasted with special love, that is something that Jesus in the Course is telling us over and over. You can have an experience of this. And when you have this experience of this, then you will, it will help you to continue to look for that experience. And the more you look for that experience, the more you will have it. And the more you have it, the more you'll know the truth about what you are. The more you know the truth about what you are, the less confused you are. You know, it's all a whole, so your theme for the day is really perfect, because especially now in the holiday season when we're you know, making a lot of decisions based on love, quote unquote, and you know, sometimes that is not the right way to make the decision, because the love that we're basing it on is really it's really special love, and a lot of the things that we do when we are doing special love is enabling, if I can bring that word into the conversation, enabling other egos to continue to believe that they are separate egos too. You know, it's, and how do we move out of that? How do we move out of that so that without becoming heartless, which is really, you know, what the world would tell you, well, if you're not crying over this, then you must be a heartless person. But if you were really looking at this whole situation, the total situation of the sonship from the viewpoint of the ego, you can't help but cry all day. But if you look at the sonship in relation to how the Holy Spirit sees us, then you would be in complete joy. And, you know, I think what Jesus is proposing here is that if you are in that state of complete joy where you are actually having no conflict because of this false empathy, then you would actually be able to be more helpful, more loving, more open, more honest, less afraid. And in fact, you wouldn't be afraid at all. And that actually brings the rest of the sonship up into, it's where, you know, true charity comes about. When I can actually see my brother as he is, rather than as, and as being the whole holy Son of God with no problems, no flaws, no, you know, nothing going wrong with you. You're just perfect the way that you are. If I could actually do that, then that would help the rest of the whole sonship lift up into that place too. So
yes,
we're not just doing this work for myself so that I don't cry every time I read the newspaper. It's so that I can see myself as I truly am and see my brother as they truly are and know us as the Christ and not as this illusion that we're so convinced of that that is tearing our hearts apart.
Yeah. And I'd say, I like what you said, you know, cry every, I mean, because that's a perfect example. Because I think it's very appropriate, I think, in some cases to shed a tear or many when we contemplate what's going on in the world, you know, either on a, you know, large scale or a very close personal scale, and think about how crazy it is. But at the same time, and also to laugh when we see the humor in it, you know, on the level of form. You know, last night I watched a few of my favorite comedy shows, you know, just to kind of catch up on some of the things that have been recorded. And you know, I had some good belly laughs. And at the same time, watching the special love and the special hate, you know, if you think of, you know, using those lenses or filters, if you will, of on watching the mind's activity of the self that I think I am, the separate self that I think I am, relating and reacting to other seemingly separate selves. You know, it's like, well, okay, there's nothing wrong with that. If everything that is changeable, that is subject to coming and going and existing and not existing, is part of this massive dream, then what really, I think you alluded to it, you know, earlier, what really helps us long-term is the gradual identification, slowly but surely shifting our awareness. And that's where the decision-making mind of the Of Course in Miracles addresses comes in, from the sinful, guilty, fearful self, as Ken Wapnick would call it, to that self that watches, that is beyond change, that is beyond space and time and individuality and specifics and specialness, and sees that with a very infinitely, eternally peaceful contemplation. And as we begin to identify more and more with that, the calm that comes over us, even in the midst of, you know, shedding tears over something that grabs us emotionally, whether it's a piece of music or you know, that we're really moved by, as it happens to me not infrequently, or a news story, or, you know, something that you hear of, you know, from someone you know personally that, you know, has an emotional impact on you. Or on the other side of it, the seemingly, you know, exuberant events that come and go. If we can look at both of those with the same inner peacefulness that doesn't change, and develop a constancy of identification with that, that I think is what pulls us through. And I think that's what you know, to get back to this the middle part of lesson 95. That's what Ken Wapnick is talking about, is to be able to look at the craziness of and the fickleness and the equivocations and the fluctuations and the inconstancy of this egoic thought system that we made up, that's just a dream, with an inner sense of gentle amusement, of kind-hearted astonishment that couldn't possibly be what we really are. It's certainly the who that we've identified with, but that who is a facade of, you know, vast proportions, even though it seems like it's localized and isolated to this one person, and, you know, going through a specific time period in what is this 21st century planet Earth's history. It's just a silly game. And the more that we forgive ourselves for our lapses in remembering that, which I think is what this workbook lesson talks about, is, and when we make judgments, but we don't judge ourselves, or when we, you know, see the condemnation in the world, when we, for example, you mentioned, you know, Donald Trump and something he said, when I am more mindful now, looking at things on TV or web or radio, whatever, newspapers, and I see things that are designed to raise hackles and to give a rise, which, you know, having worked in the video industry for a couple decades, you know, if it bleeds, it leads, kind of is the mindset of a lot of the media, and recognize that that is something that is merely a mechanism that I gave form to basically present an opportunity for me to continue to identify with a thought system that keeps me mindless and that doesn't serve my best interest or anyone else's best interest, which are all the best interests are really beyond comparison, are the truly shared interests. And that's our stepping stone. That's our training wheels for getting back to that perfect oneness. By being kind and by seeing, and particularly to ourselves when we have those lapses. I think that's, again, where this lesson comes in. Do you mind if I read those paragraphs?
Oh, go right ahead. Please do.
Okay, yeah. Yeah, so I think this is like the seventh paragraph. It starts in on lesson 95 in the workbook. The Holy Spirit is not delayed in his teaching by your mistakes. And there's no judgment about mistakes in the course, of course. That's not like Mr. there. Of course. He can be held back only by your unwillingness to let them go. Wow, isn't that powerful? Because it's really our tenacity to maintain this identity of a fake world that really brings us any seeming grief. And it's interesting how when we let go of it, even in brief moments, we realize the dream, you know, the illusory dreamy nature of those things that we got so emotional about or so upset or angry or depressed or, you know, discouraged or whatever, you know, pick your negative emotion about. Therefore, let us be determined, particularly for the next week or so, to be willing to forgive ourselves. Two words to underline there, forgive ourselves for our lapses in diligence. And I think particularly, you know, those of us who have been studying the course for a decade or two or three and realize, gee, I'm still seemingly, you know, back at those basic lessons. You know, I've given everything in this room all the meaning it has for me. I've been looking at that one lately because I've been working on redesigning those pages for the English version of the website and you know, putting all the sentence and paragraph numbers in, and they're thinking, wow, that's, even those early workbook lessons just say the whole thing. You know, we gave it all the meaning it has. Okay. So forgive ourselves for our lapses in diligence and our failures to follow the instructions for practicing the day's idea, which is to say, if we can see how it's purposive that we identify with the emotional content of what's going on in our dream drama world during the day, and choosing to feel bad of, oh, I didn't do this, or I did do that, or someone did this, or someone didn't do that, or, you know, all the behavioral things in the dream drama, and to just look at that without condemnation, and particularly our involvement in it, because, you know, I was thinking about what I associate with Dev's phrase. I'm not sure he came up with it, but I like it. And I think of him as the "if you spot it, you got it" kind of thing. That whole idea that if we identify with something in someone else, it's basically a reminder that ideas don't leave their source, and that is really where the true helpfulness comes in. Is we bring it back to the pivot in our mind, the altar, the decision making fulcrum or crux in our mind, where we say, oh yeah, I'm the one that chooses what thought system, what teacher I apply to this specific, and given any specific, any you know, political organization or family issue or biological you know, problem, you know, or, you know, health regimen, financial issue, you know, pick whatever category or whatever specific that seems to be crossing our mind on a given day or a given moment, and realizing that's where we can forgive ourselves for our lapses in thinking that that could possibly be what we are. That the perfect oneness that we are, you know, is smiles gently throughout all these little episodes of that come and go, of the same things that change. So let me just finish the paragraph, and then we go
on. Please.
This tolerance for weakness will enable us to overlook it. And the tolerance isn't basically saying, oh, let's indulge in, you know, shooting sprees or in, you know, self-destructive or other destructive behavior, you know, as the world defines it. You know, it's not about that at all. And that's usually the first, you know, comeback to people who, including ourselves, to say, well, gee, isn't the course then all about this sort of licentious thing? Well, again, it's not about behavior. And naturally, if we choose the teacher of kindness, our behavior will reflect that. And we will do the thoughtful, considerate thing that is truly serves everyone's interest optimally, because we're not thinking in terms of who's going to benefit here. We're just, you know, getting our little separate selves out of the way. And then what truly is of benefit to everyone will then shine through, and it will be reflected in our behavior. Just as a matter of consequence, natural consequence. Okay, so then it says, there may be a temptation. There may well be a temptation to regard the day as lost because you have already failed to do what is required. This should, however, merely be recognized as what it is, a refusal to let your mistake be corrected and an unwillingness to try again. And that kind of ties into those three steps of forgiveness, the reveal, release, and replace cycle, which is the first two we're asked to, you know, do our part, our willingness to look at the ego's insanity. And the last two is to let it be replaced. We just have to get the heck out of the way. And if we refuse to do our part, that's basically saying, I'd rather be miserable. I'd rather identify with the emotion that's happening, including the special love, the, you know, being smitten with infatuation, which is, and I like to do wordplay. So the other day, a few months ago now, I guess, I was thinking about infatuation and how that special sort of, you know, a nice word to describe special love. And then insinuation, the opposite, is that special hate, right?
Insinuation, I love it.
Are you insinuating something here?
Oh, that's hilarious. That's so funny. I love it.
Go ahead.
So I love how Jesus just really turns around and let me go back to that because I had something else. Can you just read that? In fact, just read that last sentence that you just... couple of sentences and go ahead.
Yeah, sure. There may well be a temptation to regard the day as lost because you've already failed to do what is required. This should, however, merely be recognized as what it is, a refusal to let your mistake be corrected and an unwillingness to try again. And that's the metaphor that I often, you know, think of when I catch myself feeling guilty or condemning myself or judging myself for not being mindful, is kind of like, instead of seeing the rope ladder there, you know, that's been rolled down by our inner kindness teacher saying, hey, climb on out of there. You know, you could do this easily. the ego hands us a shovel and said, oh, let's dig a little deeper here. You know,
yeah,
it was really only a puddle that was a half inch deep. But now that you've, you know, made a big deal out of it, now it's, you're in a, you know, 70-foot cavern, you know, it's a big hole in the road kind of thing. And now it seems to be a much bigger problem. It's still the same problem. There's no magnitude in truth. But boy, by throwing, you know, heaping more guilt around it and more self-condemnation around, you know, identifying with emotionality or identifying with you know, infatuation, you know, or insinuation, you know, either way, the special love or the special aid, either one is just a silly, forgivable game. It's part of the ego script that we can watch as it scrolls past, and just not identify with it. You know, we're not trying to trap this, you know, capture the moment. We just let the moment be what it is and let it go, because anything that's ephemeral is not going to make us happy or sad, in truth. And that's where the real joy, the non-dual joy, the perfect oneness that doesn't change with the things that change, which are all special love, hate, ephemera.
So Jesus really just calls us out there, and he says, you know, don't quit making excuses, you know, because you didn't pass that test, doesn't mean you got to quit school, you know, you didn't do it exactly like, you know, I started out this morning, I've been awake for quite a while, and, you know, when I wake up in the night, and this is when ego, like 3 o'clock in the morning is the time when ego gets really active in my mind, which is, I mean, not that it's not totally active all the time, but for some reason, when I wake up at 3 o'clock, 3 o'clock in the morning, and starts bringing up all these things about, you know, stuff that's going on in the world and terrible things that happen to people. And then what I do is I go into this little spiral. First, you know, I'm asking the Holy Spirit, you know, help me to see this differently. And then I start making up stories as to how it looks different or it could be a good thing. I start, you know, I mean, I just go into this just in-depth spiral with the ego. And so, you know, if I don't get a hold of myself, then, you know, I could be in despair all day. You know, I could be miserable all day long. But every moment you have another chance to gladden yourself. And that's, this is what Jesus is saying here. He said, you know, don't be stupid. You know, don't think that, you know, just because you didn't get it right the first time that you'll never get it right. Just keep going because this ego thing is got all sorts of tricks and ammunition to keep you thinking in its thought system, not because it's evil, not because it's trying to, even though it does want you dead, and he tells us this many times. But you know what?
Not your friend.
Not your friend.
Kids, don't try this at home. Don't try this thought system at home.
But it is actually, you know, it's got all these ways of trying to ensnare you and entrap you. And for me, you know, it goes to the things that affect my heart. Well, my heart is only affected because I believe that I am something special and separate and different. And, you know, I've always had this idea that I should be able to fix this. You know, I should somehow or the other, I'm responsible to make sure that children are not starving. I'm responsible to make sure that tsunamis don't, you know, come up and destroy villages. For some reason, I think I'm responsible for that. And of course, the ego tells me that. But in reality, I am, because I'm the one who made up the story and I'm the one who's believing the story. So to be able to shift out of that place where you're in that shame and sorrow and pity party little thing going on, to being in the mind of the Christ and to thinking with the mind of the Christ, that takes practice. And so that's why Jesus is telling us, is that, you know, so what, you screwed up, don't fall down, keep going. And, you know, I know, you know, you're, even by thinking that you were bad to do that, you fall right back into that trap. So even the guilt that you feel for having screwed up is putting you right back into that same trap. So you got to get completely out of it. And I was looking at in chapter 16, it's right after the true empathy, the power of holiness. And paragraph 2 of this, he says, there is a tendency to fragment and then to be concerned about the truth of just a little part of the whole. And this is but a way of avoiding or looking away from the whole to what you think you might be better able to understand. But for this is but another way in which you would still try to keep understanding to yourself. A better and far more helpful way to think of miracles is this: you do not understand them either in part or in whole, yet they have been done through you. Therefore, your understanding cannot be necessary, yet it is still impossible to accomplish what you do not understand, and so there must be something in you that does understand, and that something has got a capital S with. So I'm you know, I continue to go on this cycle where I'm blaming myself and fragmenting and saying, but what about this? And then this happened, and look at this poor person. And I just got an email that Helen Bogart has breast cancer and is having a difficult time. You know, my heart goes to Jean and Helen, and you know, I that's a way of fragmenting. And now that doesn't say don't help them. It says, don't see this as a separate problem that is somehow or the other special and different and deserving of your attention.
Right.
Because there's not one problem, not your body, not your health, not your children, not your money, not the war. There's not one single thing that is worth giving away the whole kingdom of heaven for. And so knowing that the something in me that does understand is here always, and is here always as a comforter, as a mentor, as a teacher. It's here to help me through this. If I would but call on the miracle. But instead of calling on the miracle, I go into how can I help? And I'm completely avoiding the only way that I can help. And the only way I can do anything is by allowing the Holy Spirit to perform miracles through me.
Yeah, yeah. I'm here to be truly helpful. That's a great reminder, isn't it? Because the true help is, and again, it certainly is in no way suggesting that, you know, we not provide whatever financial help we can to the, you know, or material or you know, being there physically or, you know, whatever help is appropriate given our seemingly specific circumstances. Of course, we should do those things, but not to beat ourselves up for what we can or cannot do. And certainly, like you point out, the most important thing is to remember that the real help, the true helpfulness, is in our mind of seeing everyone as they really are, and seeing which is really the one being, and that the training wheel idea for that is shared interest, that we're all in the same boat. You know, that every seemingly separate person is an expression of that oneness. But the only responsibility we have is to accept the atonement for ourself. Well, that's a capital S self. And that includes everyone. but all we have to do is recognize that little fulcrum in the mind, the little pivotal point where we have a little like the old Frankenstein movie knife switch, where you know you throw it one way and you get one power one circuit, or you throw it the other way and you power another circuit. And we're either powering the ego at any given moment by making the dream real, making big deals out of stuff, and you know, certainly that doesn't mean not doing what we can to support Helen and Jean or any other people we know that you know that we care about and appreciate, and they're certainly in that category. But it also means that at the same time, we can see that their true being, which is the same as ours and same as everyone's, the same as the people on any aspect of the shootings in Southern California this past week, or in some natural disaster in some other part of the world that we're not even aware of in the news, you know, which in my case, I haven't had too much time to even watch the news lately, but to recognize that there's that compassion that is really a non-dual compassion that sees through the dream. And we might be in tears at the moment, but there's a part of us that is growing in constancy and growing in our identification that says, this need not be. This, whether it's a happy dream or a sad dream, it's still a dream, right? And thank you for bringing up that section in chapter 16, the power of holiness. Yeah, that's good stuff.
Well, yeah, and it's stuff we don't remember. You know, if we're not, we don't remember these things, then it you can wake up in the night and be in upset because you're not remembering that you have that power. And for me, you know, it's not wishful thinking. That's another thing that I think a lot of folks, they will have including me. So I'm going to just say me instead of a lot of folks. And that's one thing that I do tend to do fairly frequently. And I think it's because maybe I'm not going to blame it on my Catholic upbringing. But there is.
Sure, go ahead. Why not? Who cares?
Tendency to when I thank you. We're an equal opportunity.
We're all alcoholics here.
Well, yeah, it's exactly. So, but the tendency to when I get upset or worried or think that something is going wrong, to go into this panic mode where I go to, you know, saying a mantra or a prayer or calling on Jesus or, you know, of course there's nothing wrong with doing any of those things, but it's my confusion and my mistake is that I'm actually calling on the power of the mantra, calling on the power of the word, calling on the power of the ego, instead of calling on the miracle and letting it go. Because once you call on the miracle, once you say, you know, Holy Spirit, I'm giving this up, please, you know, change my mind about this, not change my mind about this, because he can't change my mind. He can only, I can let him change things for me. But to go to that and then let it go. And say it's done. And that's right. Calling on the real power. It's not, you know, over and over, help me, help me, help me. It's done. And then move
right.
On. I'm not there yet.
Of course, none of us are, because otherwise, you know, like Ken Wapnick says, you know, if you, which I just did less than an hour ago, you know, about an hour ago, if you do the morning slog to the bathroom mirror and see a reflection there and identify with it, then you probably still have a little forgiveness work to do, right? Because and that ties into a word that you used a couple of times there that I you know, we all do, because we think that there's separate selves is my, you know, and my is such a giveaway clue to be mindful. Play on words there. To just look at how often we use me, myself, and my, and I, and, you know, in the separate sense. And that can be like a wonderful little mnemonic device or reminder to say, oh, I'm identifying with the dream figure again. Look at how quickly that happened. I just walked out of the door of this workshop, or I switched off Pal Talk and walked out in the room to you know, get a bite to eat or use the restroom or you know, get busy with the stuff on my list for the day, and how quickly we identify. But I think that's where that workbook lesson in 95 is, you know, that we can forgive our lapses and our investment in this seemingly separate self, and how incredibly wrapped up we are on that role. And remember that it's okay, because nothing is happening during those lapses. Nothing in truth has hurt or violated or in any way endangered or tarnished, not perfect oneness, that not one note in heaven's song has been missed, as the Course eloquently and rhapsodically says it. The self that we all are as one being, beyond all of our religions and factions, and a few moments ago I wasn't meaning to disparage any specific religion, I wanted to disparage all of them equally, right?
let's be equal opportunity disparagers. Yeah.
So it's just as silly to be a Protestant as an alcoholic, right? So anyway, but yeah, or any other, but I like what Richard Bach says. You know, the real purpose of religion is defining what's true, and then remembering that we are what's true, and to take it a step further, that's the truth that never changes. That perfect oneness has such a draw for us, and that's why we keep coming back to it, like moths to a flame. Except we're not the moth; we're the light. We're the light that we think we're drawn to, and the me, myself, and I, my identity. Is never going to get reach the light bulb, and is just going to get its wings singed if it's the old style light bulb, the non-LED style, or even the compact fluorescent, probably if with enough effort, right? Certainly the flame variety, the very old fashioned stuff. Because you know, two separate objects in a dream are never going to reconcile or to meet or to find any fulfillment, and how could something designed to be separate and to fragment? And I was out walking yesterday, and I saw a street sign that I thought was funny. Let me see if I can find the photo here real quick while we're talking. It was Dublin Avenue. A lot of the street names around here in Livermore, California, where I'm been for a couple months, so are named after famous cities, and particularly in Europe. And so I was walking down Dublin Avenue, and I was thinking, well, that's a good way an Irishman would speak of what the ego's been up to. You've been Dublin Avenue, right? You keep fragmenting and doubling and multiplying. You've been Dublin Avenue.
You sound like a leprechaun.
Well, I sure am. I've got a bit of an Irish lineage in myself, in this separate seeming self, anyway.
You know, that's real interesting, and I was thinking about that the other day because of how it appears that our population on this planet is just exploding, and there's, you know, it just appears like, and I think I heard someone was saying this one day that, you know, all these people are coming back so that they can be here for the big reveal or the big awakening, whatever. And I was thinking, well, you know what? That's not really possible because, and these are Course in Miracles students too. So there are no people in the truth of it, that the sonship is whole and has never been less than or more than what the sonship is, which is the sum of all of God's creation. And therefore, you cannot have more, you know, just because there's a rearrangement of things. It's like when you go to you don't have that problem because you got a ton of hair, but I have kind of thin hair. So, you know, I go
Are
to
you
the
insinuating something.
I'm insinuating something. Not infatuating it. anyway, but I go to get my hair cut. And I have, you know, the hairdresser, you know, does it in a way that kind of fills in the spots so that, you know, it seems like I have more hair than I do. And so that's what we're doing, is we're trying to we're trying to make something out of nothing, and we're
much ado,
yes. And so we're filling in the spots with you know, extra characters, or you know, like you're doing a flower arrangement. No, here there's a little spot here that needs a leaf or a rose or something. That's all we're doing. We're just arranging and rearranging things to make it seem like more.
Right.
Make it seem more spectacular.
Yeah, it's really no different than rearranging the deck chairs on a Titanic dream. I was thinking, now you have a very personal way to feel more compassion for Donald Trump, right? So.
Absolutely. Although it really has nothing to do with the hair.
Well, exactly, because we're all hairless. I love what Ken Wapnick's metaphor is. Not only is the emperor naked, but there's no emperor, you know, which is basically saying, you know, not only, you know, is the outer shield of oblivion a fake, you know, the universe of bodies and space and time and you know, physical people, you know, a part of the dream, but also the thought that made it. That's that inner shield of oblivion, the whole the whole insane notion that there could possibly be a world where things separate and double and toil and trouble and and squeak and you know, it's just a, you know, a roaring mouse, as the course describes it in yet another metaphor that it is. It's just you know, so we can forgive ourselves for identifying with the dream and those lapses that sometimes seem like they last days or months or years, you know, and we can forgive ourselves because nothing happened, you know, like another metaphor of, you know, the footprints in the sand one, you know, that, you know, Jesus has our back while we're, you know, off in dreamland, you know, we're slumbering and he's carrying us across the beach. And so there's one set of footprints during those times. And so no big deal, you know, not one note in heaven's song was missed. We're still a safe, asleep in dreams, you know, dreaming of exile. We're dreaming of an incredibly elaborate hoax that had no effect on truth. And that perfect oneness, that unimaginably wonderful love and you know, non-dual love, which is hard for us to imagine. You know, oneness joined with as one. What's that? You know, we all say, right? But there's this there's a knowingness that beyond the shared interest that is our and our forgiveness lessons that are our classroom, there is that awareness that we never left. There is that peace that it couldn't possibly change or be compromised or be attacked by anything in the dream of space or time or bodies or the thoughts that made them, the insane thought system that made them. And we're safe. We're home. And we can remember that at any instant, whenever we choose to let go of our condemnation, our self-condemnation, because it's all self-condemnation if we're beating ourselves up, right?
It is. Yeah. And it is that guilt. See, this is what people don't really see too, is that it is when you start really looking at all these things that seem to upset you, break your heart, make you cry, make you all that, when you look at those things, look at the underlying guilt that is there, because you can say, I don't feel guilty because, you know, people are being bombed in Syria. And you can say that all you want. But if you start really looking at your own thoughts, you will see that you wish that people were not getting bombed in Syria. And that if you could do something about it, you would do something about people getting bombed in Syria, because you do not want to see that happening. And yet, right, what this course is telling you, and which I know is true, is that I do have the power to stop that. Not to just stop that, but to stop every bit of this illusion for myself, mm-hmm, by accepting the atonement. I do, right, have the power to not see that anymore. And I'm not asking to not see what's true. I'm asking, mm-hmm, I'm asking to not see the illusion anymore, and to see only that no one is being harmed, nothing has gone wrong, no animals were harmed in the filming of this movie, you know, nothing,
including
us animals, nothing, mm-hmm, happened. I have, yeah, the power to know that, because it, yes, is the truth. And so whenever I see something that's going wrong, the reason that I feel guilty is because, hey, I could stop that at any instant by changing my mind.
Yeah, exactly. As you're saying that, I was thinking, well, all we have to do is remember that everything that we would have a tendency to condemn, whether in ourselves or someone else, is a call for love. That it seemed all right, seen properly. And the only appropriate response to a call for love or an expression of love is another expression of love. And there we have it, huh?
Yep, and all expressions of love are maximal. That's the, yeah, very, very first miracle principle. And if you just understood that very first miracle principle, none of this would be give you any kind of difficulty at all, because there is no order of difficulty in miracles.
Right.
No matter what.
And that's such a helpful principle, isn't it? To, yeah, remember that, you know, the seemingly horrific holocausts and a harmless hangnail, as if for liberation, are all the same. There's no difference in truth. And yet on the level of form, it's very appropriate that we, you know, not try to behave all the same, because that would be very inappropriate to have the same level of and type of response to those two things, you know, and prioritization on the level of form. It's that would be totally silly. But then this is a very silly world.
It's a very silly world.
And the only way, like Monty Python.
The only way that you can really navigate it is through guidance and through being a miracle worker.
Yeah.
And I think Jesus is very, very firm and very clear in this. And it's our time is up, and I'm going to let the mic go to Stephanie here in a minute. But just to point out here, that there is no order of difficulty in miracles. We are miracle workers. We are not to be sitting around going, oh, woe is me, when we see things go wrong, because why? We are miracle workers. And the miracle worker gives up their right to mourn over and grieve over false appearances. The miracle worker chooses the miracle because they want to see the truth. I choose the miracle because I want to see the truth and I want to know the truth. And so I can't do that and at the same time sit around and feel sad and sorry and be woe is me about stuff. So anyway, this is a really fascinating topic, and I would love to pursue it more. So I think
we'll do that. Sounds
right.
Good. Thank you again, Lynn. I'm reachable via ACIM blog and .com and also on Facebook. And I know there's tons of links other resources. I always like to put a little quick plug in for the Foundation for A Course in Miracles. They just had a wonderful academy class that was just now streaming, and lots of great resources on the web for, you know, students of A Course in Miracles. Anyway, have a great week, all, and thanks again, Lynn. I'm really enjoying these conversations, and it's truly helpful for me.